Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 326, titled, And Mothers Shall But Laugh to See Their Babes Halved Before Their Eyes. This is being recorded on September 16th of the year 2001. The title is a reference to Mark Antony's soliloquy over Caesar's body in Shakespeare's The Tragedy of Julius Caesar. In his soliloquy, Mark Antony predicted, of course it was Shakespeare doing the writing, and the citizens shall become so familiar with death and the instruments of war that mothers shall but laugh to see their babes halved before their eyes. And this is dealing with the terrorist blitzkrieg of September 11th, 2001. And I would add, not incidentally, that in my home base, on my home base program, One Step Beyond on KFJC-FM in the South San Francisco Bay Area, I used exactly those words as my prediction for what was going to happen when George Bush got a lock on the presidency. I don't say he was elected because he wasn't elected. He was selected. Let me stress, in connection with the terrorist blitzkrieg against the Pentagon and the World Trade Center, I do not profess to have all the answers. As Will Rogers, a political comedian, said, all I know is what I read in the papers. Do I know if this was really done by Osama bin Laden? Answer, definitively, no. My suggestion, and when one studies history, is that one should examine the bin Laden phenomenon in a larger context, as one had to do with the Iranian hostage crisis of 1979-80, with Muammar Gaddafi, the terrorist bete noir of the late 70s and early 80s. Yes, they were all involved in these things, but there was much more than that. And to make a very, very long story very, very short, the author, the executive function in this particular act is what I have been calling for so many years now, the Underground Reich, literally a Third Reich gone underground, which embraces elements within Germany, elements in the Middle East, and elements in the United States, uniting all of those as part of a sub rosa state underground, literally a Third Reich gone underground and propelled by enormous economic wealth and utilizing the devastating non-Pareil intelligence outfit put together by Gestapo chief Heinrich Mueller, the security director for the Bormann Group. There are many, many tapes dealing with this. Those are available from Spitfire. Many of these are already available for download and or streaming on the websites of the very heroic sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey. Particular emphasis in For the Record 326 is going to be on intelligence failures as well as the German connections in connection with these particular attacks. It is a huge event, one just recently concluded, and again, I don't profess to have all of the answers. At the same time, there are some very clear trends emerging. The San Jose Mercury News of Thursday, September 13th of the year 2001, had an article by Earl Lane from Newsday. It's titled by the Mercury, Spying Failure Worries Experts, subtitled, U.S. Likely to Re-examine Intelligence Gathering. It's Dateline Washington. It reads in part, with the United States spending billions on counterterrorism in recent years, the successful attacks in New York and Washington on Tuesday must be considered a disturbing intelligence failure, some analysts said Wednesday. Well, yes, indeed. And was bin Laden involved? I don't know. I'd say the evidence points in that direction. But as I've tried to indicate so many times in past broadcasts, there is so much more involved with the Osama bin Laden phenomenon than one might be inclined to suspect. Please note in this regard that there are evidentiary tributaries running between the elements of the bin Laden organization and the World Trade Center bombing in 1993, the funding for which, by the way, came from Germany, and many of the key operatives in which were trained originally by elements of U.S. intelligence in the Afghan support operation. I would note in connection with the intelligence failure that there do appear to be some evidentiary tributaries running between the Cole bombing, which in For the Record Program 256, among others, I speculated might have been performed by terrorist elements associated with the Underground Reich and the Bush campaign, the Bush family being in all likelihood part of the Underground Reich, and that in fact that bombing may have been done to make the Democrats appear weak and to help give the election to George Bush. Whether or not that hypothesis is accurate, there do appear to be connections between the Cole bombing and the terrorist blitzkrieg of 9/11. The San Francisco Chronicle of Sunday, September 16th of the year 2001, has the following article by Stacy Finns, F-I-N-Z, and Carla Marinucci of the Chronicle. This account has been carried in many other papers as well. It's called Hijackers Linked to Coal Attack, and it reads in part as follows. The investigation into Tuesday's suicide attacks in New York and Arlington, Virginia, developed on several fronts yesterday as authorities disclosed that two of the hijackers had known links to Osama bin Laden, and a second arrest warrant was issued for a material witness. The team believed to have hijacked the plane that crashed into the Pentagon were being sought in the United States by the FBI and were known to authorities as associates of bin Laden, law enforcement and intelligence officials said. The men were wanted for questioning in the investigation of last October's terrorist bombing of the Kohl in Yemen that killed 17 American sailors, according to U.S. news reports. U.S. authorities suspect bin Laden of playing a key role in planning that attack. Now, in For the Record program number 322, I dealt with a very disturbing theft of a briefcase from John O'Neill, the FBI official in charge of national security for the FBI's New York office, and not incidentally, the FBI official in charge of the investigations into, or in charge of the investigations into the Kohl bombing and the American embassies in East Africa in 1998. And we're going to listen to an excerpt of For the Record program number 322 from August 26th of the year 2001 right now. Now, remember, in For the Record program number 310, we dealt with John O'Neill and the frustration by elements of the State Department into his investigation into the Kohl bombing. We reprised that information as part of For the Record program number 325. This excerpt is from For the Record program 322 from August 26th of the year 2001. Some of the fascist collaborationist elements among Middle Eastern nationalist movements and among the Arab oil-producing elements in the Middle East, some of the fascist heritage has manifested itself on this side of the Atlantic as well. We've spoken in numerous broadcasts, most recently in For the Record 315, about Osama bin Laden, whose father Mohammed bin Laden was very close to King Ibn Saud, the founder of modern Saudi Arabia, who was himself a fascist collaborator, having worked actively with the Third Reich, with British fascist St. John or Jack Philby. He also worked very closely with Alan Dulles, who in turn was a close financial and political collaborator of the Bush family, and George Herbert Walker and Prescott Bush Sr. were both heavily involved with some of the American corporations that helped to fund Nazi Germany, that discussed in numerous broadcasts available from Spitfire. In For the Record program number 311, dealing with, or actually most recently in For the Record program number 315, called Not So Fortunate Son, dealing with the death of an alleged drug overdose of J.H. Hatfield, we dealt with Osama bin Laden and the connections between Osama bin Laden and Arbusto Energy, those connections being specifically a fellow named James R. Bath, who put forth a portion of the venture capital that went to start up Arbusto Energy, George W.'s first oil venture. James R. Bath had strong connections to the BCCI milieu and was also the Texas business representative for the bin Laden family. And I have speculated about possible connections, not possible connections, but about a possible alliance between the George Bush faction of our political and national security establishments and the bin Laden elements in the Middle East, and speculated that, among other things, the attacks on the U.S. embassies at the same time as Bill Clinton was undergoing his impeachment ordeal, and the bombing of the USS Cole, which took place at the height of the U.S. presidential campaign, and along with rising oil prices and dropping stock prices, helped to make the election a lot closer than it would have been. George Bush couldn't have stolen the election if it hadn't been close. And I've speculated on numerous broadcasts, most recently in number 315, about the possibility that the bin Laden group may have done the Cole, so to speak, in order to deliberately weaken Bill Clinton and by extension the Democrats, by making the Democrats look weak. A similar pinch Answers movement was seen in 1980 when the hostage crisis and the October surprise, along with the quote, gas crisis, unquote, and the oil shortage and rising petroleum prices, helped to deep six Jimmy Carter when George Bush was running for vice president in 1980. That was George the First, by the way. Once again, the investigation into the bombing of the USS Cole has run into obstructions. In past For the Record programs, I've talked about the fact that John O'Neill, who was investigating the Cole bombing on behalf of the FBI, was denied access to Yemen in the investigation. It would also appear that John O'Neill, whether due to his own carelessness or perhaps due to the activities of some other intelligence related element, perhaps looking to destabilize the FBI in order to justify a change at the top, and we've now seen that with a Bush ally connected to the BCCI and Noriega investigations. Mr. Mueller is now head of the FBI. I would also note that John O'Neill is now under investigation for having lost track of a suitcase that, among other things, detailed all of the intelligence operations that the FBI was involved in the New York area. The following is from the San Francisco Chronicle of Sunday, and this would be August 19th of the year 2001. This is an article by David Johnston of the New York Times, the State Line, Washington, headlined, FBI Terror Expert Lost Track of Top Secret. And I believe that this is cut off here. I believe the headline talks about the top secret documents, but the paper was torn here. But in any case, page A8 of the San Francisco Chronicle, Sunday, August 19th of 2001. The article reads in part as follows. The FBI has begun an internal investigation into one of its most senior counterterrorism officials who lost track of a briefcase containing highly classified information last year. The briefcase contained a number of sensitive documents, including a report outlining virtually every national security operation in New York, government officials said. The official, John O'Neill, 49, is the special agent in charge of national security in the FBI's New York office. The job is among the most powerful in the FBI, and although O'Neill is not widely known, he has overseen cases like the terrorist bombing of the Navy destroyer Cole in Yemen last year, and the bombings of American embassies in East Africa in 1998. I would note that both of those bombings apparently perpetrated by the bin Laden forces, and there are direct connections between the bin Laden forces and the Bush forces. So I have more questions than answers about that missing briefcase. Could it have been perhaps aimed at compromising Mr. O'Neill, further embarrassing the already seriously embarrassed FBI in order to warrant pro-Bush changes within that institution? Was it perhaps aimed at finding out just what the FBI has learned about possible connections between the Bushes and the Bush forces and the bin Laden forces? That is an article about which I have more questions than answers, but it is a disturbing article indeed. And that, again, excerpted from For the Record program number 322 from August 26th of the year 2001. Note, again, the theft of that particular briefcase. Note the key position of John O'Neill in the investigations into the bombings in East Africa and in the bombing of the Cole, both of those acts being attributed to Osama bin Laden. Returning to the article from the San Francisco Chronicle of August 19th, and this again is a New York Times article. By the way, I ripped off the corner of this paper. People may want to double check it. Maybe from August 26th, but I'm almost positive it's August 19th. It is a Sunday. Skipping down in this article, I'm going to read a section of the 819 Chronicle article taken from the New York Times that I did not read on August 26th. Once again, this is called FBI Terror Expert Lost Track of Top Secret Papers. It's by David Johnston of the New York Times, and it deals with the theft of this briefcase in, not incidentally, Tampa, Florida, in the summer of 2000, in other words, before the Cole bombing took place and obviously before the attack on the Pentagon and the World Trade Center. Skipping down in this story, officials identified one document in the briefcase as a draft of the annual field office report for national security operations in New York. The closely guarded report contained a description of every counter-espionage and counter-terrorism program in New York and detailed the manpower for each operation. And I obviously don't know who stole the briefcase. It is said, because again, this theft took place in Tampa, Florida. Skipping down again in the story, Speaking of the briefcase, it was taken from him and the documents inside it were fingerprinted to determine whether anyone had touched the briefcase and whether the documents were handled by a foreign intelligence service. The investigation concluded that the documents in the briefcase had not been touched. Well, if the person had been wearing latex gloves, of course, as one might expect anyone with any intelligence or serious street criminal instincts to do, there would be no fingerprints. I once again asked the question that I've asked in a number of broadcasts, including For the Record 310. I've asked the same broadcast, excerpting that in 325, is perhaps the FBI being destabilized, in addition to its own misdeeds and mistakes, and there are those, is the FBI being destabilized by elements associated with the underground Reich, whether in our own intelligence system, the Bush White House, with the BND, or some other element? I think that's a very important question to ask and be answered. And again, note that in that briefcase was were details about every counter-espionage and counter-terrorist operation in New York. One wonders, again, whether perhaps that was intended to see whether or not the Bush-Bin Laden connection was being investigated, and perhaps whether the intended or obviously impending operation in against the World Trade Center and the Pentagon may have been penetrated. One wants to resist simplistic analyses of these and other events. As I've indicated in the past, our intelligence system is anything but monolithic. Many of the people involved in it are sincere patriots and Democrats with a small D, and others of them, however, are associated with the underground Reich and have profoundly undemocratic instincts. So one wants to avoid making simplistic analyses, but I think the situation vis-a-vis John O'Neill is a very interesting one and compelling one, and I suspect that some of the intelligence failures in connection with this event must necessarily be examined in the light of the events that have befallen him. The San Jose Mercury News of today, Sunday, September 16th of the year 2001, have another New York Times article. This is by Judith Miller, Benjamin Weiser, W-E-I-S-E-R, and Ralph Blumenthal of the New York Times. It's Dateline New York, headlined by the Mercury, Bin Laden's organization highly organized and coherent. Skipping down, we read, counterterrorism officials have worried about the challenges of the new battlefield for years. Quote, it's not like the old mafia-type cases, said one senior FBI official in a speech in 1997, where you pigeonhole somebody and say he's a member of this group. Unquote. Now listen to the following. The official who made those comments, John P. O'Neill, who oversaw the FBI's investigation into Bin Laden, retired last month to become director of security for the World Trade Center. So again, I have more questions than answers about this, but again, I wonder about the compromising, perhaps, of the investigations into the Cole Bin Laden, the embassy bombings in Africa, the, perhaps the Bush Bin Laden connection, which needs to be investigated. And it's a very ominous set of circumstances. One wonders just what exactly lies behind it. A fascinating column appeared in the New York Times and was then later reprinted by the San Jose Mercury News. This column was reprinted in the San Jose Mercury News of Friday, September 14th of the year 2001. This is an article by William Sapphire, the conservative columnist for the New York Times. It's Dateline Washington and headlined by the Mercury, Is There a Terrorist Mole in the White House? Air Force One is next. And skipping down, a threatening message received by the Secret Service was relayed to the agents with the president that, quote, Air Force One is next, unquote. According to the high official, American code words were used showing a knowledge of procedures that made the threat credible. I have a second on-the-record source about that. Carl Rove, the president's senior advisor, tells me, quote, when the president said, I don't want some tin-horn terrorist keeping me out of Washington, unquote, the Secret Service informed him that the threat contained language that was evidence that the terrorists had knowledge of his procedures and whereabouts. Skipping down. The most worrisome aspect of these revelations has to do with the credibility of the Air Force One is next message. It is described clearly as a threat, not a friendly warning, but if so, why would the terrorists send the message? More to the point, how did they get the code word information and transponder know-how that established their malafides? That knowledge of code words, presidential whereabouts, and possession of secret procedures indicates that the terrorists may have a mole in the White House, that or informants in the Secret Service, FBI, FAA, or CIA. If so, the first thing our war on terror needs is an efficient counter-spy. Well, that is a very interesting piece of information indeed. As I've noted in the past, I think an awful lot of the misdeeds that have befallen this country have been performed by what is quite literally a fifth column of the underground Reich in the United States, present within our political and economic establishments, as well as our intelligence and military establishments. And if, in fact, the information presented here by William Safire is accurate, one wonders about the possible role of that fifth column. Again, for an underground Reich incorporating elements within Germany, elements within the Middle East, and the Bush family. I would also point out that one of the sources that was attributed in that particular story was Karl Rove. Karl Rove is a senior Bush advisor whose name has been cropping up in connection with many interesting things, from the sale of Silicon Valley Group to ASM Lithography Holding that I've talked about. He would appear to be he is a very formidable, very Machiavellian individual who has sort of emerged as the dirty trick specialist of the Bush White House. He was, according to some journalistic sources, in touch with Chandra Levy, among others. And Karl Rove, as it turned out, was the individual who channeled the information that was contained in the biography Fortunate Son, The Making of an American President. That was the Deep Six biography of the late unfortunate J.H. Hatfield. In For the Record program number 186, I speculated about that book and speculated about the possibility that the information about Bush's alleged drug use, as well as other damaging information about Bush, including and especially the Bush, James R. Bath, BCCI, Bin Laden family business connection, that in fact that information may have been deliberately channeled to J.H. Hatfield because of his criminal background, knowing that by discrediting Hatfield, they could scare off other journalists into staying away from that story. In For the Record program number 319, Bush League Part 3, I went into information that indicated that it was, in fact, among others, Karl Rove, that very same Machiavellian and formidable Bush operative, who was one of the sources for J.H. Hatfield's information, thus lending credence to that hypothesis that I advanced in For the Record 186. This is excerpted from For the Record program number 319. And again, that's called Bush League Part 3, The Association and Actions of the Bush Administration. That was recorded on August 19th of the year 2001. The dates are available on the broadcast itself. This is excerpted from For the Record program number 319. In For the Record program number 315, titled Not So Fortunate Son, dealing with the work of the late J.H. Hatfield, the author of an unauthorized biography of George W. Bush called Fortunate Son. This was a book that was very critical of George W. Bush, and it made a number of allegations, the most publicized of which was discussion that George Bush had been arrested for cocaine use and had been obliged to do community service. That was the allegation from Fortunate Son that received the most publicity. I've used the book in the past, specifically the original hardbound edition, which was then withdrawn from sale. And what I have used the book in connection with is the fact that one James R. Bath, allegedly a CIA officer, and in that capacity allegedly having been recruited by the elder George Bush, and who was certainly an investor in Arbusto Energy, George W.'s first energy company, and also the Texas business representative for the Bin Laden family, a wealthy Saudi-based construction, a family whose main source of wealth is a Saudi-based construction firm, whose patriarch, Mohammed bin Laden, was very close to King Ibn Saud, and, Osama bin Laden is probably the best-known Islamic anti-American terrorist, an individual who himself worked on behalf of U.S. intelligence in the Afghan War in the 1980s, and whose activities, ranging from his alleged involvement in an ambush of United States Rangers in Somalia in 1993, to the bombing of a couple of U.S. embassies in August of 1998, as the impeachment proceedings were gathering steam, which led to strong criticism of Bill Clinton on the left, to the bombing of the USS Cole, a U.S. destroyer, also apparently bombed by bin Laden's forces. That bombing at the height of the election campaign in 2000 helped to make the Democrats, and by extension Al Gore, look weak on national security matters. This, in conjunction with rising petroleum prices, is, in the opinion of some, one of the factors that helped to put George W. Bush in a position to steal the presidency from Al Gore. I first discussed the book Fortunate Son in For the Record program number 186, actually in 182, and in For the Record program number 186, I speculated about the possibility that the information, the allegation of George W. Bush's cocaine conviction might have been deliberately fed to J.H. Hatfield because of knowledge of his criminal past, and then, once the book was out and once the discussions of George W. Bush's drug use had received a certain amount of publicity, then the criminal background of J.H. Hatfield was surfaced. This led to not only the discreditation of Hatfield, but by extension the discreditation of the information alleging that Bush had used drugs, and that in turn led to, in general, in my opinion anyway, an unwillingness on the part of the news media to examine George W. Bush's background critically. There has been information that has surfaced in the wake of J.H. Hatfield's death at the age of 43 of an alleged drug overdose. That discussed in For the Record program number 315, again, Not So Fortunate Son, recorded a few weeks ago. An article was published in Online Journal, a very fine online publication. This article was written by a fellow named Sander Hicks, who has a small alternative publishing house called Soft Skull Press. And Sander Hicks, after reading a copy of Fortunate Son and coming to the same conclusion that I had come to, which was that it was a well-researched and credible book, then republished Fortunate Son on behalf of Soft Skull Press. And according to Sander Hicks, the sources that were used by J.H. Hatfield for Bush's drug use and also that and other aspects of Bush's background were not only George Bush's minister, but also Karl Rove, a key Bush aide, who, according to Sander Hicks, apparently deliberately channeled some disinformation to J.H. Hatfield in order to discredit him and may very well have been involved consciously with channeling the drug information to J.H. Hatfield, knowing that Hatfield himself could later be discredited because of his criminal background. Those are the allegations made in an article published in Online Journal by Sander Hicks. Again, S-A-N-D-E-R as his first name, last name H-I-C-K-S. This is from Online Journal of May 23rd, 2001. You can access Online Journal at www.onlinejournal.com. And this article is titled by Online Journal, How Karl Rove Tricked the Media into Trashing the Messenger While Ignoring the Message. And after discussing the furor that arose in August of 2000, August of 1999, when George Bush, in an impromptu discussion, said that he had not used cocaine since 1974, that led a lot of people to say, there is discussion here of J.H. Hatfield's revealing his sources to Sander Hicks after Sander Hicks republished the book. Skipping down in the article, we read, I swore not to repeat it to anyone, this is Sander Hicks discussing his conversation with J.H. Hatfield, but I also knew that the truth is bigger than one person. We, that's Hatfield and Hicks, would both choose to reveal the sources publicly when the time was right, when we had no other choice, when we no longer had anything left to lose. The Eufaula connection, that's E-U-F-A-U-L-A, that was Karl T. Rove. Now you know. And again, that excerpted from For the Record program number 319 from August 19th. Of the year 2001. It might have been August 12th. I'd have to go back and double-check the exact date that was recorded. So Karl Rove, apparently, was indeed one of the people who channeled the information contained in the J.H. Hatfield book to J.H. Hatfield, who was then discredited when his criminal background came out. I would note that in addition to appointing Robert Mueller, head of the FBI, an individual who has covered up many of the relevant investigations, as talked about in For the Records 310 and 325, that took place relatively early in the summer of 2001, J.H. Hatfield, a couple of weeks later, died of an apparent drug overdose, thus eliminating him from the scene as well. He was 43 years old. Yet another intelligence failure, apparently in connection with the terrorist blitzkrieg of 9/11. This is from the San Francisco Chronicle of Friday, September 14th of the year 2001. It's a column by Philip Mattier and Andrew Ross of the Chronicle titled, State Department Memo Warned of Terrorist Threat, and it reads in part as follows. Former U.S. Secretary of State George Shultz said yesterday that he was, quote, startled, unquote, by a little-noticed State Department memo that was issued a week ago and warned that Americans, quote, may be the target of a terrorist threat, unquote. The memo, issued just 4 days before the attacks on New York and Washington, identified the threat as coming from, quote, extremist groups with links to Osama bin Laden's Al-Qaeda organization, unquote. Quote, I have no idea what intelligence lies behind the warning, Shultz said, but they put this out because they had some sort of intelligence, unquote. Shultz, who served as Secretary of State under President Reagan, said he received a copy of the September 7th, quote, worldwide warning, unquote, in his San Francisco office on the day before the fatal attacks. So again, considerable failures in terms of intelligence gathering in connection with this story. This concludes Side A of For the Record program number 326, and Mothers Shall But Laugh to See Their Babes Halved Before Their Eyes. Being recorded on September 16th of 2001, my name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.